My name's Lindsay and I'm an addict. Yeah, I've been self-obsessed for a couple of days about being in this chair and going in and out of it, and it's just horrendous, and now I know why I used. Because I know that, you know, a little drink would take the edge off this feeling, you know, that I'm having right now, or, you know, I don't think a joint would help. I think that would just, that would completely spin me out. Yeah, various other drugs that probably wouldn't be of any use whatsoever to me right now. And that's the beauty of recovery, is that I'm actually able to kind of, like, you know, I wouldn't say sit with my feelings, because I don't think that's a good idea for an addict in recovery. I just don't think, for me, for this addict, it's not a good idea. If my feelings are so overwhelming, then I have to actually, you know, I have to talk to someone, you know. I have to share that with an addict in recovery. Not with a normal person. Normal people would just kind of think I'm an absolute freak if I kind of went and spilled my feelings all over them. You know, an addict in recovery more than likely will go, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. And they will, you know, have that similar experience. And it doesn't matter what my experience is. You know, it's about me listening to the similarities. And the beauty of this program as well, and this fellowship, is the diversity that we have. It's like, if you don't hear a message from me, there are like 180, 200, I don't know, I haven't counted them lately, I haven't been that obsessed lately. I have done it before, I have counted the meetings and the Where to Find before now. But there are, you know, a couple of hundred meetings that you can go to, you know, within however many miles of this meeting here, which is just phenomenal. We're so lucky here, we're so lucky. And we've got a fabulous transport system in London. It is. It's great. You get from A to B. It's like, you know, not everybody has that. Not everybody has that. Some people are stuck out in the middle of the country. Some people are isolated. They don't have the luxury of getting to meetings like we do in London. And talking about the diversity, it's like, you know, my experience of my life is very different to the previous speaker. And that's cool. That's really, really cool. Because I have to listen to the similarities. And the similarities were, you know, that when he got to this fellowship, he got the message of recovery and he started working the program. And that's what happened to me. I wasn't quite so clever, though. I didn't realise I was an addict. I knew I had problems and I knew I couldn't cope with life. And I regularly kind of went into feeling suicidal and despairing. Every 18 months, it was cyclical. From about the age of 11, I would say, it was cyclical. Had my first serious suicide attempt when I was 15. The next one at 19. The next one just before I was 21, I think. And the only reason that I stopped actually doing that was that I you know, had the answer. You know, I got pregnant and had a baby. And, you know, and that actually kept me together for an awfully long time, because I had to keep it together for the sake of somebody else. It's interesting, isn't it? It's kind of that kind of like me putting somebody else ahead of my own needs was what I needed. And that's what I do here as well. So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of amazing, really. So I was born in 1968. I'm 40 years old now. Apparently I'm looking very good. People are telling me I'm looking very good. Which is fantastic. You know, I probably look younger now than when I first walked in the doors of Narcotics Anonymous. I looked like an old lady. Somebody's nodding over there. And it feels like the more that I've worked the program, the more that I've worked with others, the more that I've put this first within my life, it's like my spirit has woken up. Okay, I've had that experience in our 12th step where it talks about, you know, the awakening of the spirit. My spirit's woken up, therefore it feels like my body and my mind have kind of come into sync with that as well. And it's just phenomenal. There's a couple of women in this room that are over the age of 60 and they do not look it, believe me. They do not look it. They are vital, vital women who are just amazing, and they're a real inspiration to me, you know, real inspiration. So my experience, yeah, So I was born 40 years ago. You know, the minute I was born, I was held up by the legs, face down. And the doctor that delivered me told my dad, there's no need for circumcision, sir. Because he wanted a boy, you know. And so from the minute I was born, it's like I've been this kind of like, there's been this kind of disappointment surrounding who I am, what I do, all this kind of stuff that's actually been coming from the outside. Now, I'm not saying that's what makes me an addict, okay? That's not what makes me an addict. But it kind of didn't help that you know, circumstances in my life were that you know, my parents were not married. They pretended to be married. I kind of got the feeling that they weren't married, though. Years into it, it's like, well, why don't you celebrate anniversaries? Why don't you, you know? But it was like they were giving this illusion that they were a happily married couple. My dad worked in the US Navy. He was a commander. You know, my mother's Scottish. And, you know, they used to throw huge parties for personnel, quite high up people. I would go, you know, upper class people is the kind of people that I used to mix with, and it was funny because it was just that illusion. It was just the beginning of the lies that kind of went on that surrounded my whole life, basically, where it was kind of like, you know, everything was quite dishonest. Everything was dishonest, you know, and it all kind of had a face that couldn't be kind of cracked, really. Really, really, you know, and I had everything, you know, my dad earned quite good money, the US government paid for me to go to boarding school, you know, I had an education, I had, you know, the clothes on my back were fantastic, we always had masses of food in the fridge, it was, there was always a lot of, and there was a lot of booze around, a lot of booze, alcohol. And you know, I was kind of like, you know, I used to be able to mix with adults a lot better than I did with children, if the truth be known. I could talk quite well to adults, but I couldn't really talk well to children. I couldn't really relate to other children. I always felt different, and if truth be known, I was different. You know, I'm not going to kind of say, well, I wasn't different, it was just the addict within. No, things were very different for me, you know. My dad was like 28 years older than my mum, you know, so when he would pick me up from school in his big American car, I felt different, you know. It felt like my grandfather picking me up from school, and it was quite embarrassing. But that's how self-centred I was, and that's the diseased bit. That's the diseased bit of me, was that I was incredibly self-centred. It was all about me. It was all about how things affected me. And, it was different. It was very different, and I kind of grew up with that. And I was always trying to figure out, you know, why do I feel different, you know? I thought maybe it's because I'm a Virgo. You know, I thought maybe it was that thing of like, you know, my dad being American and my mother being Scottish, they're completely different cultures. It's like, is this the kind of, you know, they're completely different ends of the scale, those two cultures. But no, it wasn't that. And I got into, you know, the first time I got drunk was at a family do. The children sat at one table, the adults sat at another table. We were drinking Welsh's grape juice that summer, and you know, some guy came around basically pouring, I know some people have heard this, but pouring wine into our cups, and I remember sniffing it and thinking, that doesn't smell like Welsh's grape juice. I remember drinking it and going, that doesn't taste like Welsh's grape juice, but I glugged it down and I asked for more, and I got totally rat-assed, totally off my face. And that was not the first time I'd touched alcohol, because believe me, when there are parties going on around you when you're, you know, really young, you go around and you drink the dregs because no one is noticing, and you know, and that was quite normal. So that was kind of my first experience of being drunk, and I was 11 at that point. It was the summer holiday and I was 11, and then when I was 12, I went back to school. I was in the second year of secondary school, and that's when my friend suggested that she'd been shoplifting, and wasn't it a great idea? And I was just like, yeah, that sounds fantastic. And it wasn't like I needed it. I didn't need, you know, it's like I had plenty of stuff. But it was that thrill. It was that thrill of going down to the shopping centre, you know, to Woolies, especially back in those days. It's like there weren't really security cards, and we ended up getting caught in, you know, after a series of sprees, because we just week in, week out, we were shoplifting, and we ended up getting caught in Sainsbury's nicking 3 cream eggs. But we also had like 2 carrier bags full of stuff, just absolutely full of stuff. Parker pens, calculators, I mean, just all sorts of stuff that we really didn't need. We just didn't need, but it was the thrill of nicking the stuff. And we'd actually nicked the bags that we'd put the stuff into. It was kind of like, yeah, it was quite amazing. And that's, you know, when I was just kind of reminded of that because of what the previous speaker had said about, you know, being sort of like taken to the police station, and I was hoiked to the police station, you know, that grip under the arm, taken down the police station with my friend, and we were chucked in a cell, and I was absolutely terrified, and it was at that point that I got down on my knees and I asked God for help. And yes, I got out of that. I kind of like, yes, suspended for a week, you know, from school. The shame was horrendous when I went back to school, because I knew, and it wasn't just self-obsession, people were talking about us. You know, this was a kind of big thing for our school. And the shame that I'd kind of brought on my family, really, because it was quite a small place where I grew up. It's a town called Bath, and everybody knows everybody else's business, and you know, it was just very shameful, very, very shameful. But it didn't kind of stop me carrying on. It didn't stop me kind of like drinking. I just used to drink and drink and drink. Any opportunity I had to get hold of alcohol is what I would do. And I didn't actually really like the effect of alcohol, because all alcohol did for me was black me out, you know, and I didn't really like that. I didn't like lying on my bed and being spun around the room. I really didn't like that feeling at all. And it's kind of like, you know, but I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop. And it was a good thing, really, when I kind of like, you know, got introduced to other chemicals. You know, but at the same time, it was like every time I had a kind of new chemical, like when I was, you know, when I was 11 and I got drunk, it was like I was so off my head and I was blacked out. And that to me is not normal for an 11-year-old. You know, it's just not a normal kind of thing. You know, when I had my first sort of load of spliff, it was kind of like I totally whited out and I felt completely sick, completely ill. And yet that didn't stop me from continuing and having more. Yeah, really bizarre, really, when I look back on it. It's like it was so obvious that my particular body does not accept drugs particularly well. I have to work really hard to feel comfortable with drugs in my body. So, I mean, it just carried on, basically, and I kind of, you know, I made a decision when I was 17. Well, I tried to run away when I was 15, but that wasn't very successful because I'm not really a street person. I'm just not. I hung out in a garage for about a night with a packet of, you know, 10 cigarettes. I got through the 10 cigarettes and I thought, well, I've got to go home now. I'm just not a streetwise person. I'm really not, you know. So after that kind of attempt, I'm quite intelligent. I'm quite intelligent, so I planned my escape from my home. My dad had died by then. My mum was well into her alcoholism. She used to take me hostage, and I'd be taken hostage quite happily with kind of being taken out and drinking. And I would smoke drugs right next to her, and she wouldn't seem to notice. Really, really just strange. So I was desperate to get away from this place, really. And this place was actually me. You know, this place was not what was surrounding me, okay? It was actually, this place was within me. And I remember a friend saying to me, because I'd I'd kind of applied to go to nursing college. I'd got into St Bartholomew's, and my friend said to me, "Lindsay, when you go up to London, you need to change." And I was like, "Yes, I need to change." And I came up to London, and of course, you know, I just did exactly the same things. I kind of like, you know, whether it was, you know, drinking, using drugs, whatever it was, whatever came my way, I would use. Somehow I would manage to turn up on the ward at 7:30 in the morning. God knows how, especially when I'd been out till about 6:30 in the morning and I was completely off my face. And I would have patients saying to me, "Lindsay, you need to have a mint." You know, and all this kind of stuff, and it was just like, you know, and I'd be like, "Great, you know, the patients were looking after me, and fantastic." And you know, and I had really amazing things happen to me. I remember driving completely drunk from the medical bar at Barts to the nurse's home in Hackney, which is where I was living at the time, and I just couldn't find my way. Surprisingly enough, I couldn't find my way. I was that drunk. And I got stopped by the police, you know, and I shoved a bit of chewing gum in my mouth. And we all know that doesn't work, right? We all know that doesn't work. And for some reason, these police officers, you know, they were like, you know, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "I'm a student nurse, you know, I'm trying to get back to the nurse's home, I'm a bit lost." And they escorted me, you know, with my car. They said, "Follow me," you know, and they escorted me back to the nurse's home. And things like that happened to me all the time, and it was like, you know, thank God I never killed anybody, you know, thank God, you know, just thank God, you know. And I was actually being really, I was being looked after, and I can see that now. Interestingly enough, my very first meeting when I was 19 was of another fellowship for, like, if you've got a parent who's an alcoholic, you can go there. And I went to this meeting in Hackney Hospital, and they all stood around at the end, like we do in these meetings, and they said this prayer. And they were all quite older people, like much older people, and I just thought, you know what, this is not for me. But I kind of, there was something in me that was drawing me towards the fellowships, something in me. I've got a niece who, she stopped drinking. She's the same age as me, but she stopped drinking alcohol when she was 19. She then proceeded to go to, you know, our mother fellowship. But she realised she couldn't drink anymore. And this is kind of like, it's kind of me in reverse in a way. She realised she couldn't drink anymore, but she still took natural drugs. So she could smoke puff, she said, and she could drop mushrooms. And she could have all those kind of things, and yet she couldn't drink alcohol, you know, because she went to this other fellowship. And that's another thing that I love about this particular fellowship, is we talk about the disease of addiction. We don't talk about a specific substance. And that, for me, is really, really important. I mean, I'll kind of like, yeah, fast forward a bit. When I got here, I'd had my son, I was a qualified nurse, I was holding my life together on the outside, okay? I was just barely holding it together. I hadn't had a relationship for 10 years because I just knew that I was crap at relationships. You know, anybody that came into my life was you know, the people that I attracted into my life were basically gonna, you know, I would allow them to abuse me. I would allow them to kind of like really not take good care of me at all. And so I just veered clear of relationships. I absolutely veered clear of them. I thought I'd rather be on my own and you know, not even necessarily happy, but I'd rather be on my own than be with somebody that's going to be abusive. And I had my son, and when I just before I got into the fellowship, I was going through one of those cycles again, where I was hitting bottom again. Because I believe that when I was 15, I hit bottom, that first suicide attempt, and I didn't actually come up from there. Yeah, I from the age of 15 to 33, I just dragged my ass along, okay, barely keeping alive. And I remember kind of like, it was just before Christmas. No, it wasn't. It was just between Christmas and New Year. I basically, you know, I'd totally lost faith in God or higher power or anything like that by then. I wasn't kind of like, you know, I wasn't a religious person. I didn't believe in religion. I knew it couldn't help me. And I still cried out in desperation. I still cried out exactly how it was for me in that cell when I was 12. It was like, please, God, you know. But this time it wasn't, please, God, help me. It was, please, God, why on earth have you put me on this planet? Why was I even born to live this life where I do actually try really hard, and nothing ever seems to go right. Nothing ever seems to fall together. I mean, it was the kind of the epitome of kind of self-piteous, kind of self-loathing. And I wasn't asking for help. I was asking, why have you put me here? Within days of that, I'm not joking, within about 10 days of that, I was sat in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And it was only a few months after that that I started to realise why my life had been such a sorry ass tale, you know. I didn't think I ever deserved any sort of happiness. I never thought I deserved anything, really. I kind of tried really hard to kind of be all right with stuff, and it just never ever was. And what I discovered when I came to my first meeting was, oh my God, I'm an addict. And I hadn't realised that. I had not realised it. And there were people around me that had realised it, but I hadn't realised it for myself. I went to this first meeting. It was a women's meeting, thank God. And all these women that shared at the meeting were heroin addicts, and they were crack addicts, and God knows what else. Now, I'd never used crack, and I never used heroin, and believe me, I didn't need to be sat here in this seat right here, right now. You know, my inner rock bottom was not about the drugs that I took. It was not about the people that I was hanging out with. It was not about me, you know, the quality of the food that I ate. It was nothing about that. It was an inner, it was an inside job, basically. You know, I had enough of the way that I was living, the way that I was feeling, the way that I was being. I'd completely had enough. And I was ready. I was ready. When I came to that first meeting, I was given this book, which is our blue book, our basic text. And I took that home with me. Women gave me phone numbers, and I was able to ring those women as well, you know, to ask for help. Because in the first few days of that of my recovery, I was all over the place, absolutely all over the place. I did have a drink. That meeting was on the Monday, and on the Tuesday, I went round to a friend's house, and it was funny because I'd never taken anything on so quickly as I had this idea of Narcotics Anonymous. She kept saying to me, have a drink. And I was like, no, I'm going to NA now, you know. And literally, like, you know, I'd only been to one meeting. I was persuaded, I allowed myself to be persuaded to have one more drink. And then after that, I basically dropped her out, you know, because I wasn't strong enough to say to people, no, you know, I wasn't strong enough. Within 10 days, I'd heard that thing where you're supposed to make amends to people, and my neighbour, who I owed some money to for drugs, because we all used to kind of like, you know, school together, I knocked on his door because I thought, I need to make these amends, you know, and knocked on his door. And as I'm giving him the money, he's got some puff in his hand, and he's giving it to me like this, and he's going, this is really good stuff. And I could physically feel myself being pushed back from him, physically. And it was such a weird thing. It was such a weird thing. And I was like, no, and I quickly ran off into my house, you know, and and I didn't, you know, that was another day where I hadn't scored, where I hadn't used, and I got through it, you know. And those early days of recovery were really, really tough. It's not easy. Like I said at the beginning of my chair, to have these feelings that can be all-consuming is not easy. It's not easy to have those feelings and not use. That's not, like has been said, that's not natural. That is not natural. It's the most natural thing in the world for me to use. You know, that's what kind of keeps everything dampened down. That's what holds me together. And that's probably what kept me alive for an awfully long time until I found the program. What I now know, though, is that, you know, I basically did it, like it's been said, a day at a time, a day at a time, a day at a time, a day at a time. I did what was suggested. You know, I got to meetings, as many meetings as I could. I didn't do 90 meetings in 90 days. I think I did 87 meetings in 90 days. I thought I was going to relapse because of that, but I didn't. I got myself a sponsor. Anytime I felt like using, I rang her. You know, I rang her and she'd say to me, get to a meeting. And I'd be like, right, okay, I'll get to a meeting. And I just didn't pick up a day at a time. I just didn't pick up. And I rang people all the time. You know, when there wasn't a meeting to go to, I would pick up the phone and I would ring people. And I might come off the phone and feel all right for about 2 minutes. And then I'd have to pick up the phone again. Because I couldn't sit with myself. I could not sit with myself. And why should I have to when I've got you lot out there ready and waiting to help me? You know, why should I have to sit with myself? I don't have to sit with myself. I got through this day at a time, day at a time, day at a time. Picked up, you know, keyring. Got a commitment. Got quite a few commitments, actually. Had to let go of a couple of commitments because, took on too many commitments. And it's been a process. It's been a complete process. It hasn't been like a flash of white lightning that kind of happened overnight for me to get to where I was then to get to where I am now. It's not been like that. That has not been my experience. My experience is that I have put one foot in front of the other. Okay, sometimes I've had to do just the next right thing and not think of anything further than that. Sometimes I've had to get up in the morning and go, right, what do I do now? Oh, yes, I'll go to the toilet. Okay, I'll go to the toilet. Okay, what do I do now? Okay, I read my Just for Today. I have my coffee. I might have a bath. I'll brush my teeth. I'll put my clothes on. Might not be in all that order. But it's like, it is sometimes, it's just a matter of what's the next thing I have to do. And that completely enables me to live in the moment right here, right now. And not kind of project about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week or next year. Because that's where my disease will feed on, the fear of the future and the kind of, you know, whatever of the past, because I don't really have it anymore. What is it? Thank you very much. Yeah, shame, the shame of the past. I don't live in shame of the past anymore. So I've done this kind of like day by day by day, week by week, year by year. I've also kind of had the experience of sponsorship. I've gone through sponsor, 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 sponsor. And I've been through the program a few times. I haven't been through the program because I've thought, yeah, it's a really good idea to do the 12-step program over and over again. It's just because I've got new sponsors. I'd have a new sponsor who would take me through the program again, and then I'd get a new sponsor who would take me through the program again. So I've been through the program a couple of times. I'm on my third round at the moment. And it's amazing. It's an amazingly simple program, but I have needed somebody to show me how to do it. I've needed that. You know, I haven't been able to just, like when I was given this book on the first day at that first meeting, I read 2/3 of it, and there's no way that this is not a self-help program. This is not a self-taught program. You know, I need my sponsor, I need other recovering addicts to help me to learn how to practice this program in my daily life. Not just I've done step one, not just I've done step seven now. You know, I need to work all these steps on a daily basis in order to have peace of mind and to feel all right with myself. And it's taken me a while to learn that. It's taken me a while to actually realise the simplicity of this programme. It's taken me, a while, you know, to realise it's much simpler than I thought it was. Much, much simpler. I'm shaking again. So I'm working with this sponsor who is the best sponsor for me at the moment. She's definitely the best sponsor for me at the moment. She's an incredible woman. There's only a couple of people in this room that know her. And she's just amazing. I just spent 3 weeks with her. She doesn't live in this country. I looked for a sponsor for 6 months in this country, and I asked loads of people, and I couldn't find one, you know. And I asked this person who happened to be visiting my home group, doing a share at my home group, and she immediately said yes. And we do it through email, telephone, and as I say, I've been to stay with her earlier in the year, and it really works. It really works. She is me. She is me. She says that I'm the mini-me, like, in London, because she lives in California. I want what she's got. I also want what I've got. Today, I want what I've got. I'm really happy with what I've got, but I actually want what she's got. And what she's got is she's got vibrancy. She's just amazing. She's full of really simple suggestions, you know, which help me work through my difficulties. She's teaching me the program in a different way. As I've said, it's kind of like it's become simpler, even simpler, you know. I have to work this program. I can't not work this program. The disease of addiction. I did a step one recently where it's like I was practicing my step one without practicing the rest of the program, which when you've been around for a little while and you know some of the tools, it's all too easy to kind of fall into doing those tools. You know, to ask for help, to ring someone, to pray, to, you know, whatever you need to do to kind of help yourself. And I was doing this step one without using the rest of the tools, where I was kind of like, you know, I have had these, you know, a situation might happen and I'd get these feelings inside me that would come up, and I'd have to really, really practice kind of like leaning into that feeling and realizing that's my illness, and it's alive and kicking. It's completely alive and kicking. And I did it for a whole week, this kind of just leaning into my feelings. Yeah. And it was quite incredible to realize how powerful the tools that I've been given of this program are, but also on the other hand to realize that my illness is still alive and kicking within me, you know. And it's about me, sort of like I reach out for help. You know, I get insane thoughts as well. That's, you know, that I do. I reach out to the God of my understanding to get removed. I practice step three, just by kind of, you know, allowing what I call God to kind of enter into me and to help me. to actually help me, you know? And then I can practice steps 4 and 5 by what is it? What has made me feel this way? I know nothing can make me feel this way, but it's, you know, and I can look at, you know, why is that affecting me? Why is that affecting me like that? And because I've worked a step 4 and a 5 with a sponsor, I can trace those feelings back to when I'm a teeny tiny child. Everything always comes back from my past, and I happen to drag it into my present and reenact things. That's what I do. That's exactly what I do. And then I need to kind of practice the step 6 and 7 where I kind of like, you know, I recognise what are my defects of character. You know, my big one at the moment is my judgmentalism. It's like I am extremely judgmental towards everybody. And that's, you know, a combination of me being arrogant, you know, of me being a know-it-all, just loads of little, you know, being a perfectionist, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I'm really having to kind of like work on not being so judgmental, not so harsh, not only on you guys, but on myself. It's like I'm the biggest judge of me as well. And then with step 8 and 9, it's like, you know, do I need to make an amends to anybody? Have I acted inappropriately? You know, I've made an amends to somebody immediately today because I reacted in a way that wasn't appropriate, and it wasn't kind, and it wasn't caring, and it wasn't loving, and I had to turn around immediately and say, uh-oh, you know, sorry about that. And I'm not saying that amends are about being just saying sorry, but there was more to it than that. But it was like, I cannot carry that stuff around with me anymore. I just can't do it. It just doesn't sit right with me. And then 10, I'm learning to... I was doing a solid written step 10 for quite a long, long time. And my sponsor at the moment is trying to get me into internalising my step 10 and to actually practising it as I'm going along, not necessarily getting to the end of the night and kind of having to write it. The written stuff, though, I must say, it has been extremely valuable because of the written stuff, it's like... I've written again and again and again stuff, and it's helped me to internalise what questions to kind of to quiz myself on through that step 10 process. With my meditation, I keep it really simple. I'm not that great at meditating. My Just for Today helps me first thing in the morning. It helps me to focus. It helps me to focus on what I'm supposed to be doing that day. Having a bath, going for a walk. My meditation's it's, you know, it's not sitting down going om. It just isn't. It's a very personal thing. And then my step 12 is I try to carry this message. I try to practice these spiritual principles in all my affairs. And I can't remember the last bit. What's the last bit? I can't remember. Whatever. And let go of my perfectionism. And I try and work this program to the best of my ability, and I'm not perfect at it. But at the same time, it's like I'm really happy with who I am today. I'm all right with me, and that is a miracle. That's a miracle, you know. But it's taken time. You know, anyone that's new here, please don't give up straight away. You know, day at a time, day at a time, day at a time, day at a time. You know, it's enabled me to cope with stuff that would have been really difficult to cope with in the past, that I would have used on for sure. You know, and I'm going to leave it there. Thanks.